The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you, my fellow Americans, are citizens of Assassination Nation. A nation brought into being by America's first African-American president, standing on the shoulders of giants of warfare, of spycraft, of technology, and the rationalization of violence in the name of America's greater moral principles. Over the next hour, we shall see how the Obama administration may have brought us into a new era of warfare, conflict, and international relations where unilateral action and violation of international borders is the hallmark, stealth is the strategy, and drone aircraft are the frontline weapons. One slightly frustrating problem, we mostly miss our targets. Our intelligence is regularly suspect, and the complications to international relations and the identity of America as an exceptional nation with an almost holy mission of world peace seems to be the chief casualty here. This is President Obama's sketchy outline of the operational rules of the use of drones in assassinations back in September of 2012 on CNN.
It has to be a target that is authorized by our laws. It has to be a threat that is serious and not speculative. It has to be a situation in which we can't capture the individual before they move forward on some sort of operational plot against the United States. And this is an example of where I think there's been some misreporting. Our preference is always to capture if we can, because we can gather intelligence.
The actual criteria written in a variety of classified and unclassified documents and public statements, it has to be a target authorized by law, a serious non-speculative threat, where capture is simply impossible before a plot against the United States becomes a reality, and avoiding civilian casualties at all costs. The journalism investigative organization The Intercept has assembled a detailed panorama of this policy from classified documents and sourced interviews that accuse the United States of killing people they deem who are threats, quote, people who have no rights, no dignity, who have no humanity. They are simply designated, quote, selectors to a drone pilot who pulls the trigger. Furthermore, The Intercept source says over the past 14 years, the national security establishment has become, quote, addicted to this machine, to this way of doing business, that it seems like it's going to be harder and harder to pull them away from it the longer they're allowed to continue operating in this way. Let's get some more details now from Ryan Devereaux, staff reporter at The Intercept. He's the lead reporter on the Drone Papers piece on Afghanistan, manhunting in the Hindu Kush. Ryan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, the president saying we'd rather capture than kill them, that's complete bunk based on your investigation.
Well, so the investigation that I worked on looked at the special operations campaign from 2011 to 2013, and it compares raids, you know, on the ground where they grab detainees and airstrikes, and you see dozens of detainees grabbed, and you see, you know, over a couple hundred people killed in airstrikes. And, of course, the big difference there is that in a raid, you can grab people, take them in, interrogate them, and if, you know, they aren't the right person, you could conceivably let them go. But in airstrikes, that's not an option. You know, there's a tremendous number of people that were killed in the course of this particular campaign in the effort to, you know, take out a few specific individuals.
Can you describe generally how America's technological superiority is used to take cell phone data, cell phone information, electronic metadata, transmit it into GPS coordinates, put it on the screen of a drone operator, et cetera?
Yeah, so this is actually a pretty big concern, even within some sort of circles within the military special operations community, is that this has become a sort of obsession with what the United States can do with this sort of technology. That you can track a cell phone, you can track it, you know, in these very remote places, and it seems like you have a really good sense of your target and where your target's moving and what they're doing. But really, what you're doing is watching a cell phone. You know, in the absence of human intelligence or, you know, anything to corroborate what you think you're looking at, you're basically tracking a piece of technology around. And there's concerns, certainly from our source on these stories, that has become a really driving factor in these so-called targeted killing operations.
A beep is a defendant. A beep is a terrorist, when in fact a beep could be a lot of things.
Exactly. I mean, the source described situations and, you know, repeated sort of situations where you know, you would think that you're going after a real hot target, and it turns out that this is just the, you know, the phone of a mother of a target.
Is there any serious repercussion there, or is it just a oops?
So one of the most sort of striking components of the Afghanistan story that I worked on is that the source basically described that, you know, there's a practice when you're dealing with these sort of operations in really remote places like the border regions of Afghanistan and Pakistan, where a missile hits a suspected target and a number of people are killed alongside that target, and those people are deemed enemies killed in action unless evidence emerges to prove otherwise. So if they're military-age males, MAMs, as they're called in military parlance, and then he says, you know, without a doubt, then those folks are going to be labeled EKIA, enemies killed in action, unless there's some reason to believe that they weren't, that emerges later.
So accuracy, 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10?
So there's a stretch of time in the campaign that I look at. It lasted basically through the summer of 2012. It was right after the Obama administration decided to sort of shift gears in Afghanistan, draw down the big army type of war and focus on special operations, right? And so they ramped up the airstrikes in this particular campaign. And the data in the military's own documents indicates that over that period, nearly 9 out of 10 people who were killed in the airstrikes were not the intended or direct targets of those strikes.
Oh, so 1 out of 10 accuracy.
So 1 out of 10. So there's a term that they use, and it's a jackpot or JP. So jackpot or JP is when you either capture or kill the person that the mission is aiming to remove from the battlefield. So if you get that person, capture him, kill him, then that's a jackpot. And so what the documents do is break down the sort of rate of jackpots compared to EKIA, so anyone else who's killed in the strikes. And over the course of this entire campaign, you had 35 jackpots and over 200 EKIA.
Can I back you up for a second? Let's just focus on the language for a moment.
Yep.
Jackpot, EKIA, right. Acronyms are famous in the military. But we've also got baseball cards here being used to identify targets. All kinds of weird fantasy sports language to describe fantasy slaughter.
Right. Touchdown is another one.
Yeah. What's that mean?
Touchdown is when you hit the phone that you were looking for.
Ryan Devereaux, where do you go from here?
We go on reporting on these sorts of issues, and we hope that something changes.
The Intercept contacted folks in the administration at all levels of the security establishment and the White House, and all were told they didn't comment on, quote, classified materials. Ryan Devereaux, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Devereaux is a staff reporter at The Intercept. You might call this jackpot number one, November 2002.
Needless to say, he's been an individual that has been sought after as an Al-Qaeda member as well as a suspected terrorist connected to the USS Cole, so it would be a very good thing if he were out of business.
Then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld speaking about the death of Al-Qaeda Senyan al-Harti, a suspected terrorist involved in the USS Cole bombing, likely the first victim of a U.S. drone strike outside of a combat zone. November 2002. We're a long way from then. How does our current drone program compare, and what sorts of tensions of morality, of tactics, of strategy, of due process for that matter, does it raise? Joining us now, Andrew Coburn, author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. He's also Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. First of all, your just impression of the Intercept window that they bring on the whole drone program.
Well, it's a great scoop. We do have, really for the first time, we have the actual inside documentation of this ghastly machine that's been built up over these last few years to carry out manhunting. For all the talk of high-tech precision or precise precision, as our president likes to call it, of these killings, it's actually pretty haphazard. I mean, that sort of that statistic of when they were embarked on their, whatever they call it, haymaker or something, campaign in on the Pakistani-Afghan border a couple of years ago, 35 of the people they killed were the people they sort of set out to kill. There were 200 others or 200 people they sort of got killed along the way. So, you know, what we've all been saying for years is that, you know, this was actually a pretty haphazard business, and they were just killing a lot of innocent people along the way, you know, are confirmed from the inside. So yeah, I was pretty interested to see everything I've said absolutely there in black and white.
It seems like the technology of drones, for some reason, postpones or allows us to completely ignore the notion that human beings die.
Yes, well, the purported technology of drones. I mean, as I just said, you know, it turns out it does inflict rather a lot of casualties, or at least, you know, other people. Yes, indeed, it saves American lives. Except that, does it really? Because, yes, you know, you can go out and, you know, knock off Mr. So-and-so, you know, from the safety of your armchair in, you know, in a trailer in Nevada, or from the safety of the Oval Office. But we're still at war. We've been at war now since 2001. As Obama said yesterday, the war's going to go on a bit longer. So, you know, in the short term, yes, it saves American lives. In the longer term, the war seems to go on and on and on. Doesn't actually get us anywhere.
Well, let's take two arguments then. How do you respond to the, we've had no terrorist attacks, we're absolutely safe here in the United States, all of what we are doing is responsible for this. So, Mr. Coburn, please cease and desist.
Well, now, that's very nice. You know, we weren't hit. We weren't attacked by giant lizards either. Do we? You know, do we thank the drone program for that? I mean, they use this excuse. Thanks to our wonderful drone program, we've kept the terrorists at bay. I think people might also be noticing that during that time, September 2001, Al Qaeda was basically, they lived in caves in Afghanistan. They lived, you know, there was just a few hundred of them in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Nowadays, Al-Qaeda, or with the, you know, its spin-offs, they occupy territory the size of Utah. They control 7 or 8 million people. We're fighting a war against them. I mean, we're gearing up to fight a war against them. Things aren't going very well. So I would say the drone program's been very clearly and obviously, with anyone half a brain, has been a bit of a bust.
Andrew Coburn is the author of Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. He's Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. Always great to talk to you, Andrew.
Likewise.
The celebration of drones and covert ops and techie warfare and targeted killings and America's heroic attempt to fight off the forces of barbarianism and evil can be seen each week in the Showtime series Homeland. It is a ripping good series if you buy into the mythology and can suspend your disbelief that the locations are not in the basement of the White House or Langley headquarters at the CIA or the Pentagon or Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. Probably some friendlier nation who even possibly allows us to position drones on their soil on occasion, as well as Hollywood cameras. But some of the Arabic graffiti scrawled along the concrete wall of an onset Syrian refugee camp in the second episode of this season is a dead giveaway that we're not in Syria. Homeland is racist, say the Arabic characters, and there is no homeland can be seen on the set. Karim Kapp was one of the three artists who drew the subversive messages. Karim joins us from Berlin, where he's a graphic designer and cultural researcher. Well, boy, Karim, to you, right?
My God.
What was your mission? What was your mission?
Well, our mission when we undertook to hack the Homeland set was basically to both give the occupants of the refugee camp on the Lebanese-Syrian border a voice, but also to break the fourth wall. So we chose certain messages after getting in touch with friends, relatives, and acquaintances who sent us a lot of quotes, a lot of proverbs, a lot of song texts, which are also on the set. I mean, it's not like the things that are going viral right now are the only things that we did. But we did want to comment on the very way that the show for the past 5 years, I mean, it's entering its fifth season, so we have 4 years of representation of a whole part of the world in a very black way, and only in a relation to their interactions with the protagonists of the show. The people from the Middle East and Southeast Asia who are featured on the show are either with the CIA, so with Carrie Matheson and her people, or against them, but they are not allowed to exist outside of this context. And even though you might argue that the show is entertainment and pop culture, and I'm not going to say it's a badly produced show. As a matter of fact, I have a lot of respect for the way the show is put together, but I cannot respect the message it brings, and I cannot respect the way it forms opinion and the way it forms prejudice of a whole part of the world. a lot of people don't interact directly with this part of the world, which means they don't get the opportunity to actually get to know these people. So they are left with their prejudices. And what we want to do finally is start a call to be able to see beyond this created image, to see beyond the way people are represented on television, the way they're branded on television by religion, by descent, by region, by skin color, and for people to realize we are all human. We are all in the same shit together.
The idea that Homeland's entertainment value is based on a celebration of the narrative of violence that America has, for one reason or another, imposed on your region of the world, does that shape your response here?
That shapes my response as well. However, I will say this very simple thing, and I will swear. So Homeland establishes a narrative in which all the participants on the war on terror are equally fucked up, and they need to fight to overcome the differences. They need to kill each other, they need to murder each other, they need to commit heinous acts, which are also committed in real life. The show does create a narrative of violence, and it does say that this violence is necessary. But by creating this very, let's say, bipolar and dichotomous narrative, it doesn't give space for a gray area that goes beyond its narrative. So in the episode we're talking about, the Syrian refugees are either refugees, or the Syrians are either refugees or they are terrorists. They are not people. They're instrumentalized to send a certain message to the viewing public.
Hmm. Can I ask you a practical question?
Sure.
What's it take to convince a showrunner and a location producer to allow you to get on set with a can of spray paint?
The story of this is that the show's producers contacted Don Carl, who is a friend of mine for a few years now. And this man literally wrote the book on Arabic graffiti. It's called Arabic Graffiti. Together, we also published a book called Walls of Freedom, which is about the graffiti of the Egyptian Revolution. And he did call a lot of people before getting in touch with me. And a lot of people turned this down for ethical considerations and because of Homeland's reputation. We got talking. The show's producers had contacted Don asking for Arabian street artists, which is a very Orientalist view. And in a sarcastic reaction, we decided to adopt that name. And so Don Heba and I are the Arabian street artists of the Orient right now. And then we decided to take on the job for the same, let's say, ethical considerations that other people had turned it down for. But we also decided that we would try to insert our message into it. And like I said, we gathered a lot of proverbs and so on and so forth. And then we were driven to the set and started working. And we were there for 2 days in which, I'm not going to say the people weren't nice to us and they did take good care of us, but they also didn't really care what we were drawing. I mean, they asked for authentic graffiti, and that is exactly what they got.
Well, Karim Kapp, thanks so much.
My pleasure, my pleasure.
Karim Kapp is a graphic designer and cultural researcher. He spoke with us from Berlin.
You ain't gonna grow up into nothing, making eyes all over the place. Anybody who amounts to something always looks the world right in the face.
Time is the silent current. It holds us all. It ushers us through the mystery of how the present becomes the future. It lets the past slip away from us and make sure we weren't looking. The clock of time sometimes is the subtle tick-tock of language itself.
One of the things that I've noticed is my white privilege.
Listen to the voice of Sharon in St. Louis earlier this week in one of our broadcasts from Missouri, answering the question, what has changed for her since the events of Ferguson mysteriously reset her clock, her language, her words?
I don't know that I was ever as cognizant of that as I should have been, but I see it as a prevalent part of my life, why I am who I am and what happened to me, because I have had white privilege.
I was feeling that quiet, deep river of time this week as our humble little radio program keeps asking every way it can, what's happening now? Is something changing? is our yoke of racial curse and self-imposed violence, brutality sculpted in the brilliant logic of educated thinkers with many more college degrees than I have. Could all that be crumbling?
It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover that the flag to which you have pledged allegiance along with everybody else has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you.
1965, writer James Baldwin, author of The Fire Next Time, speaking with a seething, quiet, almost orchestral fury, debating in Oxford, England, the proposition is the American dream at the expense of the American Negro.
The Southern oligarchy, which has until today so much power in Washington, and therefore some power in the world, was created by my labor and my sweat, and the violation of my women and the murder of my children. This, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, and no one can challenge that statement. It is a matter of historical record.
Baldwin, with his proud, hard-won, cold steel erudition, confessing his humiliation in an America of Jim Crow, preoccupied with the nuclear age and the space program, with bigger matters to concern it in 1965 than some social aftermath, the downstream details of slavery. The white American quarterback of team privilege himself, William F. Buckley, steps up confidently to defend the American dream, which you can see on his smug face needs no defending from this mildly interesting upstart.
It is impossible, in my judgment, to deal with the indictment of Mr. Baldwin unless one is prepared to deal with him as a white man. Unless one is prepared to say to him, the fact that your skin is black is utterly irrelevant to the arguments that you raise. Thus, Mr. Baldwin can write his book, The Fire Next Time, in which he threatens America. He didn't, in writing that book, speak with the British accents that he used exclusively tonight. In which he threatened America with the necessity for us to jettison our entire civilization. The only thing that the white man has that the Negro should want, he said, is power.
Fast forward to 2015 in a grand hall at the New York City Public Library. That applause is from last Thursday for someone who's not-so-hard-won erudition still necessitates a confession. Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of the book of the moment, Between the World and Me, talking about a fear James Baldwin would no doubt understand.
I think as a young man in Baltimore, I was afraid of everybody else. And then when I left, I realized that they were afraid too. Everybody was scared about what was going to happen to somebody on their block. And the best way to protect your block, and this is going to sound crazy. The best way to protect your block was to go out and do violence against somebody else and then establish a reputation for your block so that nobody messed with you. The best way was to protect yourself was to project this untrammeled, you know, notion that you just talked about, this almost superhumanity. The best way to guard yourself against, you know, the violence of, you know, all young boys around me was to pretend that, you know, at a moment's notice, you know, you would take somebody out.
Coates was the star attraction at this event, being interviewed by Khalil Gibran Muhammad of the Schomburg Center on Black Culture. He says his frustration that led him to write Between the World and Me came from loving James Baldwin, but feeling the world around him, particularly whites, were stuck in the world of 1965.
One of my great frustrations even today is how our conversations around racism and conversations around our color line, conversations around white supremacy, for whatever reason, tend to begin roughly around the time of the Moynihan Report. Mm. It is that everything before, nothing, you know, before 1965 really, really matters. That if you want to understand the black community, begin somewhere around the war on poverty and then proceed forward, which is lunacy to me.
He says African Americans experience violence and discrimination and racism, all the familiar words you see and hear in the media. But he uses language to raise the ante and declares all of those words to be forms and consequences of plunder.
When I write an article for The Atlantic, it's never enough for me to win the argument logically. You got to feel it. You're not just aiming at the head, you're aiming at the heart. It's not enough for somebody to read the article say, wow, that was correct, and then forget about it. Better for the person to read the article and say, I don't know if that was correct, go to bed thinking about it, wake up thinking about it, walk down the street thinking about it, turning it over and over and over again. You do that by being very, very choosy about your words and how you articulate things. Plunder was just a true word.
And with that word, he comes back to the very argument of James Baldwin, and it's striking to see how little the argument and the circumstances of that argument have changed in 50 years.
And so normally we think about the period of people taking things from black people as ending with slavery. It's even in how we talk about, you know, segregation. You know, we don't think about, like, say, folks being barred from the University of Mississippi as plunder, but it is. It's a public institution. They tax you for that. Right. And you have to obey the law, and you have to hold up your end of the social contract, but you don't get the same protections. And that's plunder. That's a con.
And then, in a moment I found astounding, Ta-Nehisi Coates actually, without realizing it, reaches back to William F. Buckley's smug argument about Baldwin missing white culture by focusing only on white power, and answers Buckley 50 years later by agreeing with him.
Black identity has two really dominant things going on. It has the race portion, which is put on us. People say, you know, you know, we have defined you as part of a black race. And then you have a cultural and an ethnic portion of it, a traditional portion, a historic portion that defines how we talk, that defines a certain familiarity between me and, you know, a Khalil, for instance, that defines certain foods, certain musics, a whole, you know, folk ways. And that really is what is in the Howard University chapter. White identity is very different, you know, and I, you know, I'm willing to have a fight about this. But as far as I can tell, you know, white identity is essentially an identity of power. It's just a racial identity.
Did people in this packed audience think anything is changing, has changed? Is the language moving, helping, morphing towards something we might someday call justice?
No, I don't think so. I think, again, that comes so much from what people's backgrounds are, what the how they grew up, what sort of environment they grew up in, and, you know, and what their life experiences were. And if they always lived their life in this bubble of, you know, everything being handed to you, or you're allowed to do whatever you want to do, and you never really see the other side of America.
Things are changing because of this moment, the last couple of years that have preceded it. And particularly I'm talking about the relationship between the African-American community and the police. I think that's something that this writer, Ta-Nehisi Coates, really addresses in his work.
I would say that in certain quadrants, in certain circles, certainly in certain conversations that I've had, we are at least having a conversation. Which is different.
I've become less hopeful. It doesn't change anything.
No answers. And why would we make a barometer out of a middle-aged lefty crowd in Manhattan anyway? It's something. And it's something that we would not have heard with this diverse and as large of an audience even 2 years ago. Ta-Nehisi Coates is part of the change, but also the deeper change on this night. There was no William F. Buckley. No one missed him. No one missed anyone like him. But 50 years later, we all understand the American dream a little bit better. We're calling it the Great American Do-Over, releasing prisoners, reclaiming justice. On October 30th, the Justice Department will begin to release 6,000 inmates from federal prisons to ease overcrowding. The decision to release the prisoners came last April from the U.S. Sentencing Commission, a judicial agency, which voted to reduce sentences for drug crimes for an average of 11 months as part of a comprehensive plan to deal with sentencing reform. This week, we're asking, who are these 6,000? And a lot of other questions that arise here. The Marshall Project analyzed the data on 17,466 applicants for early release, finding out where they're from, their race, their citizenship, their records. Joining me now is Bill Keller, editor-in-chief at the Marshall Project, the news organization focused on covering the criminal justice system. Bill, 6,000, does that sound like a lot, or is it a drop in the bucket?
It's more than a drop in the bucket. I mean, to put it in context, there are something like 2.2 million people incarcerated in America, but only 200,000 of those, a fairly small slice, are in the federal prison system, and which is what we're talking about here. You have to keep in mind that the federal system in a typical year releases upwards of 50,000 people just because they finish their time. So it's not something that people are going to suddenly wake up in the morning and they're going to be former prisoners marching down the street. They're dispersed around the country. It will scarcely be noticed. But it's a kind of event, and it's a moment, I hope, for people to pause and think a little bit about the issues surrounding incarceration.
In your reporting, would you say that the federal government is conceding that this release amounts to the conceding of a mistake?
I think they've sort of bent over backwards to avoid conceding that. When the Sentencing Commission ruled last year that they were going to create these new sentences and make them retroactive, the justification was crowding. And there are studies that show something like 30% overcrowding in federal prisons. I think most people understand that, and we'll read this rightly as a sign that we went way overboard in the war on drugs.
Who are these people? What's the range? Anybody particularly, someone who's like an absolute no-brainer?
They are all drug offenders, overwhelmingly people of color, overwhelmingly men, more Hispanics than blacks, I think 25%, 24% white. They've been serving time for drug offenses, mostly related to cocaine, either crack or powder cocaine or methamphetamine. Their average sentence was roughly 11 years that will now be cut down to about 9 years when they're retroactively released.
Does the application process seem to be interested in whether these individuals have a support network on the outside in addition to whatever programs they might be eligible for, reentry programs, halfway houses, drug rehabilitation, and family?
Well, there you have to sort of go state by state, because the vast majority of the people who are in prison are in state systems, and every state is different. A number of states have begun to put a premium on these risk assessment tools, and you are regarded as a less risky person to release if you have a support system out there. A number of states have begun to take money that used to go to lock people up and keep them in prison for long periods of time, and using that money instead for alternative drug treatment, put them in mental facilities, and also to help reentry programs. But it varies so much from state to state. At the federal level, not a whole lot has been done.
So great, we release these people. Is that it? Is the responsibility of the government, of law enforcement, of the social network such as it exists finished at that point?
It shouldn't be. And that's not just a matter of we want to be nice to these guys and, you know, give them a less inhumane experience in prison and a nice job when they get out. It's, by most counts, something like 40% of the people who are released from prison will be back in prison in 3 or 4 years. And that's because we've been woefully bad at providing them with opportunity. We have laws that keep them out of federal housing. We have all sorts of impediments to employment, to admission to universities. We make it very hard for people to do anything but go back to a life of crime in this country. And that's not a matter of just the milk of human kindness. That's a matter of self-preservation, of protection, of safety.
There's a huge sort of arc of history that starts in the 70s, takes another step in the Giuliani era in New York, and then places around the country where law enforcement and incarceration practices and drug laws got very, very stiff and steep and intense and draconian. And now we're somewhere else. Are we out of the woods? Have we fundamentally turned a page?
I think the page is turning. I absolutely do. I mean, it's a combination of factors. It's long period of time with the crime rate relatively low. It's the growing up of a generation, the millennials, who never experienced Willie Horton, probably wouldn't know who you were talking about, who didn't go through the crack panic or any of the sort of unnerving unrest of the 60s, and who tend to be more in favor of reform than earlier generations. And it's the birth of a genuinely bipartisan kind of common ground. Obviously, not everybody on the right or everybody on the left, and not on all issues, but on the basic thought that the criminal justice system is broken, there is a left-right consensus now. So all of those things do make this a potential pivot point in history, but it's a potential. It doesn't mean that the legislators will have the spine to do it.
Well, soon we'll have 6,000 windows, 6,000 stories to tell of precisely that damage and perhaps some notion of where we go from here. Bill Keller, it's always great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Keller is editor-in-chief of the Marshall Project, a news organization focused on covering the criminal justice system. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
As a duly designated representative of the city, county, and state of New York, I order you to cease any and all supernatural activity and return forthwith to your place of origin or to the nearest convenient parallel dimension. That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
Is it unfair to call Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman movie busters? That would be unfair. Kristen Meinzer is culture producer for The Takeaway, and Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday. They're both the hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome for Friday Movies.
Hi, John. Thank
you. What do you have today? Bridge of Spies is a big release, lots and lots of ads. It's the Coen brothers linking up with Steven Spielberg, and it's all about the Cold War.
You can't accuse Abel of being a traitor. He's not an American.
Listen to yourself. You're defending him already.
I'm hungry.
You're rehearsing it on me. You said you were just thinking about
it. I am just thinking about it. It's very hard. Everyone deserves a defense. Every person matters.
Jim, what do we deserve? Do you know how people will look at us? The family of a man trying to free a traitor?
What's he trying to make a decision about there, Kristen?
All right. So Tom Hanks is playing an attorney, and this is based on real events, who is enlisted by the CIA to defend a suspected Russian spy in the States. And in addition to defending this spy, he also eventually has to trade the spy to Russia for an American being held captive there.
Prisoner exchange.
Yes, a prisoner exchange. That's right. And so this movie is very old-fashioned in its filmmaking. It's very slow. It's almost 2.5 hours long. And I do have to say that that's to its detriment. I think it's too slow. It's very beautifully shot. Tom Hanks is obviously likable. He's always likable. I do like that message of we shouldn't give up our ideals of liberty in order to feel more secure. But this is just it really drags out. This is not a snappy movie. There's not a lot of action. There's a lot of talking and not much else.
The Coen brothers seem to really want to shift our view of the Cold War away from the John le Carré kind of constructs. Do they succeed or does it get overwhelmed by the plotting nature that Kristen's talking about?
I have to disagree with the plotting nature comment. I actually really enjoyed this film. I mean, I think the Coen brothers do have some humor in here about how the CIA works and sort of the Byzantine nature of the bureaucracy, which is the kind of thing that the Coen brothers are good at. But I think this is a real classic Spielberg film where he looks back to history to draw some parallels to today. You've got a guy who's talking about due process and enemy combatants, essentially, and making these speeches saying, you know, here's a Russian spy on our soil. He came here to sort of defend his cause. Are we going to defend our cause? Aren't we the nobler superpower? Doesn't that mean that we have to extend him due process and show him that America's the better country? I think it really works. I think it works very well.
Is it more profound than that little trial by no jury in Lone Survivor where they talked about the ideals of America in that movie in Afghanistan?
Oh, there's a lot of that, too.
but it's better or worse?
Oh, it's better than that. Definitely
right,
better than
good,
that.
Good, 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 good. Crimson Peak, movie number two.
She knows who I am and she wants me to leave.
Nonsense, my dear. You're not going anywhere. You had a bad dream. You were sleepwalking.
No. I'm afraid I shall go mad if I stay.
My darling, you're imagining things. I think some fresh air would do you good.
No. I have to leave. I have to get away from here.
Edith, this is your home now. You have nowhere else to go.
I've always wanted Jessica Chastain to be in a horror movie. I don't see enough movies to know if she's already been in five, but what do you think, Kristen? Or what do you think, Rafer?
I actually really liked this. This is Guillermo del Toro. It's an old-fashioned, early 20th century story, a haunted mansion. That's Mia Wasikowska's an American girl who has come to England. She's living in this haunted mansion with her husband, Tom Hiddleston. I think it's beautiful. It's like a marriage of the Brontes and Poe. I think it works wonderfully.
It's terrific. It's beautiful to look at. It's super creepy. It's sometimes shockingly violent, but it's just a great time. I loved this movie.
Podcast?
We're going to be talking about this new musical drama comedy show called My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
All right. Lots to talk about there. Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, the co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John.
You too. John.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week we talk about race, art, politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.